Welcome to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. This hour will help investors fix issues and achieve personal gain. Now, here's your host, Jay Taylor.
Welcome to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I am your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm speaking to you from New York City on this, the 30th day of January, 2018. Before I talk more about today's show, I do want to remind you that I am the editor of Jay Taylor's Gold, Energy, and Tech Stocks, and you can subscribe to that letter by going to miningstocks.com, miningstocks.com, or you can call our office in New York City, normal work hours in New York City, 718-457-1426, 718-457-1426. Would also like to encourage you to consider investing or subscribing, actually, and investing in Chen Lin's letter by going to chenpicks.com. Chen has done an exceptionally well, a wonderful job, actually, for his investors, having turned a small investment of $5,400 into $2.5 million over 10 years. Chen's a good friend of mine. We continue to trade notes, and he's on this show from time to time as well. But consider going to chenpicks.com, learn more about Chen Lin's letter. I want to thank each of you for listening to the show, making it one of the more popular shows on the Voice America Business Channel. I also want to invite you to keep your questions, comments, criticisms, and praises coming along to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. Also, want to thank our sponsors for making this show economically viable. Our sponsors for today's show, Bonterra Resources, Uranium Energy, Auron Resources, Novo Resources, and Genesis Metals Corp. I've titled today's show, Is the Everything Bubble Reaching Its Expiration Date? Kevin Duffy, Nav Dhaliwal, and Michael Oliver return. As manager of the Baring Fund, Kevin has had a magnificent track record in protecting wealth from stock market crashes, with the current equity bull market among the longest on record, and with legendary hedge fund manager Ray Dalio just now, this past week, proclaiming the beginning of a bond bear market and predicting a stock market crash. We turn to Kevin for his thoughts about the direction of various markets in 2018 and to learn how the Barings Fund is positioning its investors. And Kevin will be with us during the second half of today's show. Last week, Nav Dhaliwal, the CEO of one of my favorite junior exploration companies, namely Bonterra Resources, was scheduled to be with me, but a pressing corporate issue occurred just as he was scheduled to come on the show. That kept him from joining me last week, but I'm happy to say that Nav will be with me right after their first commercial break today to update us on that company's Quebec gold deposit, the dimensions of which are growing very, very dramatically with this year's drill program. So you won't have to wait, however, right now for any commercial break to listen to Michael Oliver. Michael is with me. Thanks for joining me again, Michael.
Hi, Jay. Good to be back.
Always good to have you with me, and it's always important for me to tell my listeners it's OliverMSA.com, OliverMSA.com. Well, Michael, you headed up your weekly missive with something like, the lids are coming off. Talk to us what you mean by that.
Well, I think the interest rate lids, bond prices down, interest rates up, is about to occur in a magnificently noisy way. And we've had a lot of bond declines, price declines, over the past 5-10 years. But they always stop, and then you go back up, and the rates go lower and so forth. And people are hypnotized by that and think it's just a process that goes forever. I don't. I think the major trend structures that could define a turn in rates to higher levels and higher levels yet again and again, in other words, change the major trend, are here. Right now, there's a day left in the month. T-bond futures are below the level they need to close the month out in order to avoid breaking massive annual momentum support structure. German bunds are below the level they need to be to save themselves. The only one of the three biggies that I'm watching is the JGBs, Japanese government bonds. Of course, they have futures contracts too. And they are marginally rat's hair above a level they need to close out the month to break. Now, they could close out next month below it and break it then. The number stays static all year. I think they're going to break. I think the JGBs will join in, and I think we're going to have a big bear market in bonds this year. Now, what does that mean? Well, I think on the other side of that, you're going to have a big bull market in commodities. I think the bull market's already begun. It's objectively measurable. We have gone up in the Bloomberg Commodity Index. You've gone up big time in copper. You've gone up big time in gold. You've gone up big time in oil. And I think the grains are on the cusp of blowing it out as well. And even cattle. So the food commodities are ready to join in this year. And I think they will. In fact, when I run my charts to my subscribers of annual momentum of corn and soybeans and wheat, You can basically take those charts and flip them upside down. It looks like the JGBs, the bunds, and the T-bonds upside down on their momentum charts. And I find that interest poetically justice there, that the incorrect definition of inflation is commodity price rise. We've had rampant inflation for all these last years, and it's gone into stocks. They don't call that inflation. It's only when food stuff goes up, then they say, oh, that inflation. Well, you're about to get it. And the bond market's about to get it the other way. So I think the lids are coming off. And there's a lot of people that would debate me on that, and they do. And there's going to be a lot of chatter on both sides of that equation. And I really don't care. If you break the momentum structures, it's over, you're gone. And right now the bonds are doing it. The soybeans are doing it right now. Corn and wheat are very close. It's an interesting situation.
It really is an interesting situation. As I look at your T-bond charts and your last your weekly missive, it's very clear, you know, where the structure is about to break down. And you're saying we are now below that level, I guess you're saying, right?
Yeah, we are below it. Yes.
We're having an issue.
Having an issue. Okay, now it's gone. Okay, I'm back.
Okay. All right, you're back. Yeah. All right. So equities, now you put out a missive today, just today, Michael, with the stock market having a second significant down day. What are you seeing for stocks? Are we nearing a breaking point here?
Shin bone connected to the thigh bone theory here. I think the real down in stocks is likely to commence in Q2, but the initial phase could occur this quarter, specifically February could start it, and we're already starting here in late January. I've got some numbers literally you know, 0.5% below where the market is right now, that if you break them next month, which is, say, in 2 days or later, you're in some trouble, and you're likely to go down. But the down you'll see there probably won't be disastrous. It'll just be, you know, several percentage points. You know, you'll get a fist fight and up and down, and they're confusing, and people will debate it's a correction or whatever. The key is to get the S&P, which right now is just above 2,800, to an area around the high 2700s as we open next quarter. Meaning if you get if you break the shin bone now and you start to wobble and you're under pressure because you've done some technical damage and you waste out the month of February and March, which is entirely likely if you do the breakage that I see, it doesn't mean you have to go down hard. All you have to do is go down a bit and then linger, because when you open next quarter, if you're anywhere between old 2750 area and 2800 in that zone just below today's action, you're in big trouble. And so I see it as a two-part thing. In other words, let's go ahead and leverage the guy down, get him down into a position to where when he opens next quarter, it's untenable. At that point, you could get something more dramatic. So I see it as a two-part process. But you could be getting the initial phase of it right now. Don't get too excited, because I don't think it's going to be a crash here right now or anything of this sort. Mm-hmm. But I think it could be the kind of wobble that fools people, that some people will view it as a buying opportunity. Others might, if they're smart, will see it as, ooh, it's the beginning of the process, which is what we anticipate. But that entails a period of confusion at and below today's action over the next 8 weeks, let's say, where you know you get some down, but you don't collapse. All you're doing is setting the stage so that when you open Q2, you're in real trouble.
All right, Michael, we're going to have to leave it go at that. But just one quick comment on gold. It's looking pretty positive, I suppose, right?
Oh,
you had a number that we needed to close above this month.
Close, 1350 or higher. Maybe we'll get it. Maybe we won't this month. Maybe it'll be next month. That's a price-based level. It's something that anybody with a price chart can see. We've been bullish since 1140, and it's enough. We're an unbroken record. Nothing has changed that view. We think gold's going a lot higher. It could be that we're in the biggest gold bull market ever, and we could be in the finality of a gold bull market, meaning we're headed for crisis situations in a lot of markets, and gold will express that.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, we hope and pray that's not true, but it is what it is, and we need to be prepared for it, Michael, and I want to thank you very much for helping us be prepared. We're out of time. Thanks so much for being with us.
Jay,
we'll look to do it again next week. All right, folks, well, don't go away. We're going to commercial break. When we come back, Nav Dhaliwal of Bonterra Resources will be with me and to talk about a very rapidly expanding gold deposit in Quebec. Don't go away. We'll be right back with Nav Dhaliwal.
Think you've seen everything there is to see in online television? Let us surprise you. Visit voiceamerica.tv today for sports, health, business, and more on demand 24/7.
Orin Resources is a Canadian-based gold exploration company focused on the company's flagship Committee Bay project, located in northern Canada, one of the best mining jurisdictions in the world. The company's current resource, outlined by drilling thus far, stands at 1.1 million ounces of gold at over 8 grams per ton. Orin is operated by the same team that founded Asanko Gold, which is constructing a major gold mine in West Africa, and Caden Resources, which was recently purchased in November for over $200 million.
Follow the Voice America Talk Radio Network on Twitter. We're at Voice America TRN. You'll get the latest fix on what's happening with our shows, this week's featured guests, and general happenings that you should know about at the Voice America Talk Radio Network. Now you don't have to miss anything when you're away from your home or office. Just go to twitter.com/Voice America TRN or follow along with us at Voice America TRN, the Voice America Talk Radio Network. We're on the cutting edge of social media. Can you keep up?
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I am your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really pleased to have with me Nav Dhaliwal. Mr. Dhaliwal is the president and CEO of Bonterra Resources. He's been with us before on this show. He brings with him a great deal of expertise and background in the exploration sector, especially with younger starting up companies, and he's doing a remarkable job with Bonterra Resources. Thanks for joining me again, Nav.
Yeah, thanks, Jay, for having me back.
It's really good to have you. Before we get started, let me just mention you're traded in Canada under the symbol BTR. You can buy it down here in the States, as I have, under the symbol BONXF. I have you about 190 million shares outstanding, and earlier today when I checked in U.S. money, it was at 44 cents. It gives you market cap around $84 million. Does all that sound like pretty much the right metrics there, Dav?
The right metrics in U.S. dollars, yeah.
Okay.
We're trading right now in Canadian dollars in the mid-50s, thereabouts. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's remarkable still, I think. You know, I missed the boat when the stock first took off, and then you've come off your highs, and you've been sort of basing for a little while here. In the meantime, when I started looking at the story again, realizing how much progress you're making in the exploration front, I said, gosh, I think this is one I need to own. And then I added a good chunk of my portfolio. Of your shares. But one of the things that's impressed me, it's always good to know you have good company when you're making an investment. It sort of helps you feel that you're on the right track. And you have some pretty impressive institutional holdings, companies that institutional holders of your shares. Would you care to comment on who some of those are?
Yeah, absolutely, Jay. And, that's something that when we're building out a company or developing on it, it's key to you start off moving the needle and markets, may or may not be there, but you keep at it. And with that attitude and how us as management have been developing the company, and in short order, we're kind of turning over the roster with the likes of Eric Sprott, Joe Foster out of VanEck, the fund. Mm-hmm. You got Kirkland Lake Gold. You've got now, Sprott USA with Rick Rule and Andy Jackson being mm-hmm. strong supporters of the stock. As we continue our news flow and building out the deposit, you're going to see more participation in that sense. And again, we're patient. We've been patient with this stock, but I don't want to leave the impression that we're sitting back and waiting for people to come. No, we're out there. And Dale, the vice president of exploration, and myself, we're out there in front of people, telling people about the story. You know, it's a very active camp, and it's definitely getting the attention that it deserves. It will be one of the next gold camps to come online in Quebec, and that's my opinion on it.
Yeah, it certainly is impressive. Tell us a little bit about the Gladiator Project, which is your flagship. For the sake of investors that may not be familiar with it, take a few minutes and just talk about the history of it, where it was a year or two ago, and where it is now.
For sure. So I'll take you back, kind of giving the geographically where we are. So Bonterra is located 170 kilometers northeast of Val-d'Or in Quebec. Mm-hmm. It's called the Urban Barry Camp, where our Gladiator deposit lies. So back in 2000, I gave conception to the company, and we've been in this area since 2010. 2012, to give you a recap, I took over the company, and, looking for management at that point in time where, again, I'm looking for guys that understand the rock, that come with years and years of experience of drilling holes all the way to the finish line of putting it in production. And lo and behold, Dale and I crossed paths and joined up and took it upon ourselves to go, listen, this is a thriving area. He looked at the Southwest trend, and in short order, before, the activity really started to get frothy in this area, we went down, and knowing all the prospectors for quite some time, I locked down as much as I could on that Southwest trend, knowing all the prospectors. So we increased our land position in early 2014 by 170%. Now, I kind of skip past. When I did take this company and cleaned it up, I took the drilling that had been done, and I had to make sense of it for the investing community. Why is it something that, where is this going? So I commissioned a 43-101 in 2012, and that was 200 meters at strike and 200 meters at depth that came out with a resource of 273,000 ounces at 9.37 grams per ton. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of Dale and I's starting point, with a showing that was over a kilometer away, and that's kind of where we started off. And in short order, starting off in 2015, we've taken that small resource and now have expanded that substantially to over 1.2 kilometers at strike, over a kilometer at depth, with now five defined zones. And again, we haven't closed this off in any direction yet, Jay.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's remarkable. I mean, and those are that grade that you mentioned, 9.37 grams per ton. Pretty sweet. We're talking about a deposit that comes right up to surface or close to it?
Actually, yes. It starts at surface and it continues all the way down. Grade is something here that, this is going to be a high-grade camp. This is your typical Abitibi greenstone quartz vein-hosted deposit. We're not teaching anybody any new geology here. This is, this sort of style has been mined for hundreds of years. So, one thing that we initiated early this year was our met test holes, so our metallurgy.
Yeah.
To show, to kind of now, it's one thing to talk about it. It's another thing to now show how clean the deposit is. So we're excited to get that those assays rolling and get that information to the marketplace as well.
So the metallurgy looks. What do you know about the metallurgy at this stage? Does it look pretty simple, or
pretty standard, simple. It's your typical quartz veins, style hosted deposit. Going back in 2017 was a big turning point for the company. This is where we were starting to turn over the rosters. In 2017, we did two bought financings totaling just over $40 million, bringing in the likes again of Eric Sprott, Joe Foster, Kirkland Lake Gold, and then shortly after, as we kept this kept the story out there, keeping it in front of people, doing, you know, interviews with, you know, like yourselves, is mm-hmm. getting the word out there that, listen, you haven't missed the boat here. The value is still there. If you're looking at this deposit, in short order, we have really stretched this out. And, you know, so the company is now well-financed, moving into our 2018 program. We're getting very aggressive on our deposit. You know, down not only just the work, just by expanding the camp. We've taken a 25-man camp, built it out to an 80-man camp. We're building infrastructure within our property portfolio so that, not that we couldn't work all year round, but it's just going to be that much more efficient with mm-hmm. infrastructure built. So I've built over 12 kilometers of, you know, infrastructure and continue to build on it. So in 2018, we're going to start off in the first half. Now, this is, we did 60,000 meters of drilling in 2017. Mm-hmm. In the first half, we're going to initiate a 30,000 meter drill program. And now that consists of four rigs on top of the deposit, two rigs being regional. And again, it's a very efficient time for us to be working out there. The ground is froze up. It's easier to move our equipment around. Mm-hmm. So with the expansion very quickly of our deposit, we're now going to kind of come back and fill in the gaps of information. You know, we're looking to target about the 50 meter spacings. And why we're doing that is the second half of this year, we plan on updating our 43-101. You know, again, 80% of our efforts are going to be on the deposit, 20% regionally. And why I say regionally is in the third quarter of last year, you know, we know what works in this area now. Till sampling, IP, ground mag, you overlay all that information, mm-hmm. and we generate targets. Mm-hmm. And in on our property to the southwest, which is called the Coliseum property, it's never been worked before. It's basically greenfield's work. And in short order, we put a drill program on it, and we found a new discovery. So we're very excited about the rest of the targets that we've chosen through this process. So the regional work that's really got us excited, you know, I don't want to discredit what we got going on in the deposit. That's fantastic. We have a very strong understanding of what we're doing here. And, you know, even to stretch that point out further, Jay, mm-hmm. is that the company has never been in such better shape than it is now of the geological understanding mm-hmm. and the capitalization that's happened within the company. Mm-hmm. So we're getting very aggressive. I believe that you will see news flow that you've never seen out of this company to date as we're getting aggressive on our program. And, you know, the excitement from top management all the way down to the guys at the drill sites, you see the enthusiasm. And it's refreshing to see, you know, the excitement that has been, you know, that's kind of moving throughout the camp down to where we are in the office side of things, that it's about time that, you know, the markets are, you know, commodities are working their ways. The markets are healing themselves. But we've never taken the notion that, you know, we're market dependent. We continue to work. We know we're onto a deposit here. And again, we're very excited.
Well, and rightfully so. I mean, if I look at 273,000 ounces over the dimensions, the initial dimensions of 200 meters, I believe you said, and 200 meters of depth, and now you're looking at 1,200. You're looking at 1.2 kilometers along strike and, a kilometer to depth, right? And I know you can't really answer this, and you won't be able to answer it until you come out with your 43-101, but you've been able to look at a lot of the drill cores. You have a lot of the assays back. If not, do you have all the assays back from your 2017 program?
No.
No, you still have more. Okay.
Yeah, we've got more, and again, we haven't stopped drilling, Jay.
So, yeah, that's the point. And also, you'll be drilling through the winter, so we'll have drill flow. We'll have news coming out through the winter, which isn't true of all the northern Canadian companies, but. Just to give it, I mean, what I would really like to know, and I know you would mm-hmm. too, and you can't answer it, but if you had something like a grade of 9.37 grams per ton, I mean, what might investors expect? I mean, I know you can't answer this exactly, but are we looking at something substantially lower in grade, larger numbers of ounces, or might there still be a high-grade deposit at these depths?
No, this is soon in short order, and we're looking forward to, you know, getting this out to the marketplace. And I believe that the grade hangs together. The continuity now, in early days, you may have argued about continuity. That is blown out of the water. You see the continuity of what we've got going on. We're developing how we're looking at this easterly plunge that's taking place here. So, you know, we see the mining widths here. You know, if you're taking a mining scenario, you know, we're building that, mocking it up internally ourselves. To answer that question, not to walk around that question, Jay, is that you're looking at a very high-grade deposit here that's going to hang together. And you're right. You know, I don't like putting numbers out there, but I believe that with the excitement that we've got coming here, that this is definitely something that will be turning heads.
Yeah, so your mining widths are pretty good, I guess. Can you give us a sense of that?
You're looking from, 2 to 4 meters. And again, this is coming from, not just theory. This is also coming from, the years of experience that we built as a team around this that have taken similar deposits into production. So this is something that, this isn't, we're not developing anything new here. This is, a similar hosted that you're seeing a lot of mines that have been built off of similar deposit, similar style of rock that we've got here, right? So I'd like to make sure that the listeners understand, and I don't want to leave this, that our aggressive program is this winter, but we continue to build on what we're doing. And what we're planning on 2018 is a minimum of 70,000 meters to be drilled out as well. So we did 60,000 last year. We were starting off with 30, but if we see where the smoke's coming from, we've got enough capital to exercise a full push on. If we're seeing again where that smoke's coming from, we're definitely going to get on top of things. And that's regionally speaking, as well. We have not closed this deposit off. The exciting times ahead of us, Jay.
So it's expanding laterally. You're still open at depth too, I guess, probably, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, so it could be a monster in the making. Those are my words. I'm not putting them in your mouth. Those are what I see as an investor in your company, and that's why we know. When I looked at it, I said, "Yeah, okay, I didn't buy it at 10 cents. Darn it!" But when you look at price to value, I think people have gone to sleep a little bit on this
here.
Story. Yeah,
there's absolutely a lot of value left in this company. If you're building out what we're looking at building out here and compared to what we have as a market cap, you definitely can see that there's a lot of value.
Yeah, not to mention you have another pretty good-looking property in Ontario called the Larder Lake Project, but we don't really have time to talk about that, and you're not doing a lot of work on that right now, but it's not costing you much, as I understand, to hold on to it. Nav, with just a minute and a half or so, about a minute left, can you tell us, just summarize then, what investors should be watching for over the next several weeks and months? What drivers might take this stock to the next level?
Well, drivers would be, watching the news flow from our drilling program, definitely keeping your eyes for that, the metallurgy, the results from that. Regionally is something that, when we're putting out news releases, we try to keep them as simple as we can so anybody and everybody can see it, from the trained geologist down to the retail investor, that keep your eyes on the results. Look at we're growing this deposit.
All right. Well, yeah. We certainly will. We're out of time, Nav. Thank you so much for being with us. It's an exciting story. I hope to keep up with you in the future on this, and thank you so much for being with us. All right, folks, we do have to go to break, but don't go away. Kevin Duffy's going to be with us. His Bearing Asset Fund has been hugely successful in down equity markets. If you believe that's maybe where we're headed, as Michael Oliver suggested, we may be headed into a bear market. You might want to look at what Kevin Duffy has to say. So don't go away. We'll be right back with Kevin Duffy.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit Facebook.com/Voice America.
Noble Resources Corp. trades on the OTCQX under the symbol NSRPF and on the TSX Venture Exchange under NVO. Its flagship assets are located in the Karratha region of Western Australia, where they are currently drilling and trenching their Perdies Reward Project. In addition, Noble has partnered with Sumitomo Mining Corporation to advance its Beaton's Creek Gold Project toward production. With over $70 million in cash and strong shareholder support from the likes of Kirkland Lake Gold, Noble is well on its way to establishing itself as one of the top junior explorers and developers in Australia.
Bonterra Resources, a Canadian exploration company, is aggressively expanding its high-grade Gladiator gold deposit in Quebec, Canada. In 2017, Bonterra raised $40 million and attracted strategic investors Eric Sprott, Kinross, Kirkland Lake Gold, and New York-based VanEck Gold Fund. Bonterra is focused on updating its 43-101 resource model in 2018 and will incorporate up to an additional 100,000-plus meters of drilling, where the dimensions of the Gladiator gold deposit has been expanded to date nearly 500%. Bonterra trades in Canada under the symbol BTR and in the U.S. under BONXF.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I am your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm pleased to have with me once again Kevin Duffy of Baring Asset Management. Kevin entered the investing business in 1985 as an analyst and also as a strategist. He co-founded a money management firm in 1988 and after the 87 crash and cut his short selling teeth during the late 1990s tech bubble. After the tech bubble burst, he co-founded Baring Asset Management in 2002. Baring warned about the housing and credit bubble of 2005-2007, shorting stocks such as New Century Financial, Bear Stearns, Lehman Brothers, MBIA, Countrywide Financial, Wachovia, and Citigroup. Kevin wrote extensively on the subject, including articles, Alan, We Have a Problem, Mr. Mozilla Goes to Washington, and Honey, I Shrank the Net Worth. The firm's two long-short hedge funds profited from the unwind, including Baring Fund, the more aggressive of the two, which gained over 100% in 2008 when most 401ks were turned into 201k accounts. So we're really pleased to have Kevin with us again to observe the current market environment and how we might prepare ourselves for the difficulties that may very well lie ahead. Thanks for joining me again today, Kevin.
Jay, good to be with you.
It's always good to have you here with me and to hear what your thoughts are. As an Austrian economist, as an observer of free markets, we're in a credit boom. I think you've called this the everything bubble. Talk to us a little bit about the current bubble that we're in and compare it with some of the more recent ones that we've had.
Well, Jay, unfortunately, we've had far too much experience with bubbles over the last 20 years. And I think they all change their spots, which is why they're not obvious every time. And so we've had the tech bubble in the late 1990s. We had the housing and credit bubble in the mid 2000s and this bubble. And each one has been basically seeded by artificially low interest rates. This one is a bit different because the suppression of interest rates went down to essentially zero, and it was for a long period of time, for about 7 years, whereas the other ones were a couple of years, 2 or 3 years during the housing bubble. And I think what happens is the public eventually comes into these bubbles at the very end. That's another sign. There are many signs that we can kind of go over. But the first two bubbles were relatively narrow. They were more sector specific. So you had the tech bubble, and then you had the housing bubble, housing and credit, basically Wall Street and the mortgage market. And yet with those first two bubbles, there were places to hide at the top. So in the tech bubble, bubble especially, it was very narrow. The speculation was really focused on the dot-coms, on the technology stocks, but the old economy stocks were really abandoned. In the run-up, in the final parabolic run-up to that bubble, they were abandoned. So you could have bought Procter & Gamble, and you could have bought some of these old economy stocks really on the cheap. The credit bubble was a little bit broader, but there were still places to hide. You still could have bought bonds and done well. The everything bubble is very different because it's essentially a bubble in everything. We have a bubble in commercial real estate. We have a bubble in bonds. We have a bubble, obviously, in stocks. So there just are much fewer places to hide, and it's been going on for much longer. The valuations are across the board higher. So you look at something like the median price-to-sales ratio, much higher than the 2000 bubble. So it makes this a much more dangerous bubble to navigate. There are just fewer places to hide.
Fewer places to hide. Are there any places to hide?
Absolutely. I think there are some places. One of the things that's happened is we've had this, it's been led, one of the main drivers, I think this boom, this bubble has had three key drivers. China at the margin got into this early in 2009 in a big way. It's been the bond market, the suppression of interest rates for 7 years, and we've had a massive bubble in bonds, peaked about 18 months ago when you had $14 trillion in government and corporate debt that was at negative yields, and FANG, the big tech boom, the fact that you've had since 2000, you've had prices in bandwidth go down 99%, and that's unleashed a boom. It's really been a second wave. So if you look at these technology waves, the dot-com bubble was a classic first wave where the pioneers take the arrows in the back, and you had 1,600 online pet suppliers, for example. There's no way that this could be supported. And so a lot of these companies went to zero. This wave, and I think this is one reason why that the bull market has lasted this long and has gone as far as it could, is that you've had this, it's a powerful second wave where you look at somebody like Jeff Bezos and Amazon.com. You had all these online companies, online retailers back in 2000, and then they got weeded out. And so this really played into the hands of the survivors. And this is where some of the big fortunes have been made. So the first thing that's happened is we've had this kind of tech 2.0. You know, you had tech 1.0 in 2000, tech 2.0. And this has been, it's been more real, more sustainable. It's gone much greater. But as a derivative of that, we've had the passive investing bubble. So, for example, all the inflows have been massive inflows into ETFs and also passive investing in mutual funds has gone into Vanguard and BlackRock. And so there has been this kind of an passive divide where on the long side, looking for opportunity, there's been so much money that's funneled into the Apples and the Microsofts and the Amazons and a lot of stocks that don't fit into these index funds, into these passive strategies have been kind of neglected. So yes, I think that's I know I'm giving you a long-winded explanation here, but in terms of where to look, you have to look over the index divide. The other area is gold. I think gold and gold mining stocks are another place that you can hide out right now. They've been abandoned.
You're known and have done very well, you know, with your shorting strategies in the past. If those three areas that have caused the bubble, the everything bubble, China, the bond markets, and the FANGs, are those some of the areas then you might be looking to short in one way or another now?
Yes. Well, we've largely avoided shorting FANG, thank God. But we're trying to look at what's right in front of us. And so, you know, our belief is that we had the bond market moves in really long cycles. We had a 35-year bull market in bonds, and it ended 18 months ago. Before that, there was a 35-year bear market in bonds. So I'm not going to predict how long the next bear market in bonds is going to be, but at this point, it's 18 months, and nobody's paying attention to this. We don't think the bear market in bonds ends at 18 months. We think it goes on for years, and it may go on for decades. So that's the first thing that we're doing, is we're looking at shorting bonds. And, you know, I'll give you an example. German bonds, the 10-year German bond is yielding 63 basis points. Started the year at 43 basis points. It started 18 months ago. At the bottom, it was a negative yield of about 13 basis points. The real yield 18 months ago was minus 50 basis points. Right now, the real yield has actually expanded on the downside to minus 100 basis points. So you're getting, so the German Bund is yielding 0.63%, and the CPI, the 12-month year-over-year inflation rate, is 1.65%. So we're shorting German government bonds. We're shorting Italian. We're shorting, you know, you can short the Japanese government bond 10-year at 7 basis points. And the country has their debt to GDP is about 250%. It's the highest in the world. So I think that's, first and foremost, that's the area that we're shorting. That's working. I think another area that's related to that would be commercial real estate, and especially the retail REITs and the office REITs. And these have actually started to work out very well. They're kind of bond surrogates, and they've been moving lower. And, you know, this is also a function of the last bubble, that the fact that we had retail square footage growth in the from 2000 to 2007. It was about 8%, and since then it has pretty much dried up, but there's still this overhang from the last bubble. And I think what's happened this time, we had a huge boom in REITs, and this was caused by the reach for yield. So the suppression of interest rates drove money into this area, and I think it's very ripe. So for example, since the election, there's been hardly any movement up in net in the REIT sector, and now especially the office and the retail REITs. There are all kinds of different REITs out there, but those are some areas that we're focused on.
Sure. What about junk bonds in general?
We're short junk bonds as well. We see the yield spreads are at record lows, and the yields on European junk, and we're not short it, but we probably should be, and the yields on European junk are actually lower than U.S. Treasuries. I mean, it's just we're in silly season right now.
Kevin, do you mentioned gold. What about gold shares?
Yes, we like gold shares. I mean, on the negative side, as you know, Jay, it's a very difficult business, and if you give a gold miner money, you know, he'll drill holes with it. But we're in an environment right now of actually very loose money for if you want to go buy a car. I mean, the financing is very very loose, very easy credit available. But if you want to start a gold mine, it's very tight. So that's a good sign. That's definitely a good sign. Also, just commodities in general. We feel that the economy right now is, you know, quote, booming, whatever that means. But we don't see that continuing, and we just feel that the price of their output price of gold will hold up, should do very well, and the input costs are probably relative to gold in the next few years should be going down. So, and they're very cheap. I mean, as you know, Jay, the gold mining stocks are very cheap.
Yeah, in fact, if I compare the gold itself to the monetary base, gold is also very undervalued if you use that metric. But, you know, the market will determine what the price is ultimately. Silly season, you say, we're in right now. That certainly seems to be a great description of what's going on. Yeah, I was wondering.
Go ahead. Jay, you know, also to add to that and to fit another piece in with gold, you know, gold has had a couple of decent years, actually. Very quietly has had a couple of good years. There were huge outflows from 2012, 2012, 2013, 14 from gold ETFs. But they're very quietly, they've done, you know, they've had positive returns over the last couple of years. And, but last year, it was the cryptocurrencies that got all of the attention. And so I think, you know, talk about silly season, the bubble that we're seeing in cryptocurrencies and blockchain, anytime a company adds blockchain to their name or changes their name or has a press release with blockchain in it, the stock doubles or triples. Now, these are the kinds of things, the kinds of wild speculation you see at the end of bubbles. TD Ameritrade was another example. They reported earnings last Monday, and they reported the 35-year and younger clients, new clients, were up 72%, and trading activity for the year so far, just for the first 2.5 weeks, was up 34%. And they said 6 to 9% of the trading activity is now in cannabis stocks and in blockchain stocks. So there's, you know, this is how crazy things have gotten. And if, you know, think about it, let's fast forward. Typically, and this is another comparison that you can make to the past bubbles, is that the first areas that tend to crack and give you a warning are the most marginal areas. So you had the dot-com bubble burst, okay? And then, and it took, there was a certain lag, but eventually the rest of the market went. And then you had, with the housing bubble and housing and credit bubble, you had the subprime lenders. Those are the most marginal. They cracked in February, March of 2007, and then you had the meltdown in 2008. So I would not be surprised if it was Bitcoin, and Bitcoin has peaked at, $19,000-$20,000, and now we're at $10,000 or $11,000. I wouldn't be surprised if Bitcoin and the cryptocurrency bubble were to burst. What do we have, 1,400 different cryptocurrencies right now? I mean, this is very reminiscent of the dot-com bubble where you had 1,600 online pet suppliers. So, you know, maybe what happens is that bubble bursts first, and that's I can see it right now. All the commentators will say, you know what, this is healthy. This is a healthy correction. We got rid of the speculative excess, and nobody's going to connect the dots. That's another thing that you can look at. This is exactly what happened. They'll say, oh, this is isolated. This is contained. They'll dismiss any dot connecting that, there's a broader cancer here. So that could also be something that gives gold a boost, that it's just not going to have competition from the cryptocurrencies, at least not as much.
Yeah, I mean, the cryptocurrencies, I mean, we have a 32-year-old son who's doing some investing now, and I sort of joked with him the other day. I said, you know, Scotty, we don't have to worry ever about a declining market anymore, do we? It just goes up every day, the S&P 500, and so we don't really have to worry, do we, Scotty? And, I would ask you, Kevin, what is to keep the Federal Reserve from pumping even more money in if the equity market starts to go down? It certainly seemed to be very sensitive. As David Stockman calls it, whenever the stock market throws a hissy fit, the Fed comes to its rescue and pumps all that money in. All of the congressmen, lawmakers in Washington seem to be more concerned about the stock market than they are about their voters, at least about the welfare of their voters. So what is to keep the Fed from this constant pumping that would keep things from falling off the cliff?
This is a common perception, and I think it's a bit of a misconception. You know, first of all, what happens, what starts the bubble, what starts the boom going, is the central banks putting their thumb on interest rates, the artificial suppression of interest rates. That's what gets everything started. And it's a process. I mean, it doesn't just, you had, you know, relatively high saving rates. You had, there were people that were traumatized by the meltdown of 2008. And so behavior takes a while to change. You had, for example, the stock buybacks. The stock buybacks, at the best time to be buying stock would have been obviously 2008, the end of 2008, 2009, 2010. Well, if you look at companies, especially in the retail sector, they dried up. The stock buybacks absolutely dried up during that time. The other thing that happened during that time was that saving rates, personal saving rate was high. So this behavior, it took a while. It took QE2, it took QE3, it took all this conditioning to kind of change everything. So getting back to your question, the Fed pumping, the Fed can, and the central banks, they can artificially lower interest rates, but they don't control economic law. they can suppress it initially. And what happens, and this is classic, you know, Austrian business cycle theory, is that when you lower interest rates, first of all, if you had a normal lowering of interest rates, it would take an increase in saving. It would take an increase in capital. Okay, that's not what's happening here. You have an artificial lowering of interest rates, so you're not setting aside more capital. Okay, and in fact, in lowering interest rates, what you're doing is you are you're discouraging people from saving. So you're actually consuming capital. The other thing is you are encouraging people to consume, so capital is being consumed at both ends of the Hayekian triangle, where you have more roundabout processes. So at the earlier stages of production, so say R&D, research and development, the early stage, commodities, that sort of thing, they're all at the early stages, and they get pumped up. Well, you see that with the FANGs to start the cycle, they were spending $5 billion on R&D. You know, now they're spending $57 billion. So you have the consuming of resources during this process, and it can't continue because you have what's happened is businesses have taken on more roundabout, longer term projects, and the capital is not there to complete the projects. So it's all misdirected. And then as this goes on longer and longer, and people, what do you see right now? Saving rates are now, the personal saving rate is at 2.93%. It's at its very low levels. And so the resources are not there. And so what's happening is interest rates are starting to go back up as a reflection of supply and demand. The resources are not there. The capital is not there. And so I think what happens is in the initial stages, yes, the Fed or the central banks can artificially lower interest rates, but then the market realities start to set in. And that's the stage that we're in, I think, Jay, is where rates are going up. And they're not going up because the Fed and the central banks are decided one day, hey, let's drive up interest rates. No, they're reacting. They're being forced by market conditions.
Thank you, Kevin. I think that is exactly right, and that's what I've believed, that it's not really the Fed. They would have us believe that the Fed is in control, that everything is done for our good, of course, by the Fed in their omniscience, and they would increase rates now because they know that it's the right time to do it. No, they don't know anything. It's the market that is taking us up, and that I think you explained it very, very well, what I think is really going on at this point in the credit cycle as well. And as Alistair MacLeod has talked about on this show recently, we come at this point in the credit cycle also when rates start to rise that banks have to sell their treasuries or else they'll take losses on those treasuries, and they start making loans and pumping money into the economy, and that sort of stimulates things too for a little while. It was really, really interesting. So we're just about out of time here, but are you concerned at all about, I mean, which way might this thing tip? We could see, I mean, if we get a kind of really devastating stock market decline with rising interest rates, which seems very logical, we could also go back into the same kind of a situation we had in 2008, 2009, only possibly worse because the bubble is so much larger?
Yes, I think that Ray Dalio, when he was in Davos, said, we are in this Goldilocks period right now where we have had this beautiful deleveraging. Inflation isn't a problem. Growth is good. Everything is pretty good with a big jolt of stimulation coming from changes in tax laws. This beautiful deleveraging. Well, we haven't had a beautiful deleveraging. The public debt as a percentage of GDP this cycle has gone from 35% to 75%. We have margin debt at $580 billion, 3% of GDP, which is about as high as it gets. We have all kinds. There's no cash on the sidelines. We're at a very precarious point, and I think the most important thing is to understand that rising rates are kryptonite to bubbles. Every single time, it's just a question of when. It's a question of how high rates have to go. And if you look at the 2-year treasury, so risk off, it let's take that as a proxy. 2-year Treasury is at 2.12%. Bond yield, I'm sorry, the S&P 500 yield is about 1.8, 1.9%. So we've now crossed over where there is an alternative. This isn't Tina, there is no alternative. There is now an alternative to stocks, to risk on. And this is the first time that there has been an alternative since September of 2008. So we're in a very different environment right now. I think rising rates are kryptonite to bubbles. It's just a matter of when, and I think everybody thinks that they have a window where the yield curve has got to invert, or we've got to go to, you know, X percent on interest rates, 3%, 4%, 5% before it kills the party. And I think everybody thinks that they're going to be able to hand over the bag to somebody else, and they're sort of playing this greater fool game. But I really think that rising rates will continue, and that will, you'll see these bubbles start to burst, maybe with Bitcoin initially in the cryptocurrencies, and then it'll start to spread. But just keep an eye on rising rates.
All right. Well, we'll have to leave a go at that. For those listening to this show, it's bearingasset.com, bearing, B-E-A-R-I-N-G, asset.com. Kevin, thank you so much for being with us today and for your insights into the markets. I think they're spot on, so I want to thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Jay. I really enjoyed it.
Well, folks, that is all the time we have today. Next week, John Rubino will host the show. In my absence, as I will be traveling to Nevada to visit a gold exploration project there. I believe he's going to have Chris Martinson as his guest. Michael Oliver will join John Rubino as well, so be sure to listen. And until February 13th, when I'm back with you again, goodbye and God's blessings to you.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.
Uranium Energy Corp.
NYSE Market, UEC,
is a leader in the coming bull market in uranium, with spot uranium up more than 40% in 2 months. The new bull market is just starting. UEC has the cash, the licensed resources, the permitted processing center, the advanced technology, and the experienced team to lead this market. Get to know this exciting company now by visiting UraniumEnergy.com.
NYSE Market, UEC.